It's a great pleasure to introduce Nura to you. Nura was born in Portugal and was in Portugal until she came to the UK when she was about 18 to do her master's. So she's another of these wonderful blue sky people, and we don't have much of that over here. And she did her master's at Southbank University, and she's now at UCL, the domain of is the free will or is the not free will. I was talking to the professor in her department when I was at a conference and asked him, is the free will? And I knew what his views were, so it wasn't really surprising when he said, of course not, don't be so silly. And so I said, well, okay, what happens when you go home to your wife? That's nothing to do with you. And that, I think, really frames the debate very nicely. So it's a great pleasure, Nura, having you here. And you're going to talk about how do we know what we are doing? Evidence for prospective sense of agency. I mean, lovely title. Thank you so much, Nura. And I'd like you all to welcome her.
Okay, so I'd like to first thank the organizers for the invitation. It's my pleasure to be here. And so I work with Patrick Haggard, and I'm doing my PhD, just finishing. And I also just wanted to say, if anything is unclear during the presentation, please feel free to stop me and ask about that. Otherwise, we'll have more discussion later. To start, we make lots of decisions every day, and these can be more or less difficult, and they can also have more or less clear consequences. And we normally feel like we are in control of our decisions and our actions, and this sense of freedom in the decision is normally important for us to feel responsible for our actions and their consequences. But how does this sense of control or our sense of agency come about? How do we know about what we're doing or why we're doing it? And how do we know who's in control? But first, I just wanted to take a minute to think about how we can study such complex ideas as our sense of agency or the sense of freedom in our decision. And so to do scientific research, we have to simplify the questions we ask to obtain situations in which we can control the input or the conditions in which we put our participants to, and then observe how the behavior changes. And we need to do this to be able to exclude alternative explanations for the behavior we're observing. So, for example, in Pavlov's experiments, which you might be familiar with and which we can see referred to here, Pavlov would normally ring a bell shortly before delivering food to his dogs. And he found that the dogs learned the relationship between the bell and the food such that they would actually start salivating once they heard the bell and even before they saw the food. To figure out this relationship, Pavlov had to repeat these conditions many times, ring the bell, and observe that the animals were salivating to try and exclude the possibility that they were salivating out of their own free will or to control Pavlov or for some other reason. So by repeating the conditions, you can try to figure out what are the causal mechanisms for this. And of course, we need to remember that the trouble is sometimes our simplifications in studying these topics can stray quite far from the questions we started out with. But the hope is that through small controlled steps, we can build up and then try to elucidate these very complex issues. So to give a brief outline of the talk, I'm going to start by considering what's the sense of agency and how do we operationalize it in our experiments. And also consider that their sense of agency can sometimes be illusory, it can be fallible, sometimes we can be wrong. But our sense of agency is grounded on internal bodily signals, And it's also related to how we make decisions. And this is the prospective aspect of the sense of agency that I'm going to be focusing on. So we think that the sense of agency is our subjective experience of being in control of our actions, and that through them, we can control events in the outside world. And this experience depends on establishing a link between our intentions and our actions on the one hand, and between our actions and their outcomes on the other. And so, for example, imagine you walk into a dark room, you decide to switch off on the lights, you press the light switch, and the lights come on. You're probably going to feel in control of the lights coming on in this situation. But contrast that to a situation in which you distractedly walk into a dark room and the lights just turn on by themselves. You'll probably be surprised for a little bit because you didn't have the intention to turn on the lights. Then you'll probably realize there might be motion sensors or something in the room, which explain that you did actually cause the lights coming on, but because of that. So in our experiments, we try to study how people establish these links between intentions, actions, and outcomes. Okay, so you might also wonder, well, why does this matter? Why should we study this topic of the sense of agency? And of course, the sense of agency is pretty critical to our sense of self, and because it helps to distinguish when between self and other, when I am in control of a situation or when somebody else is. And we need to monitor our actions to assess what control we have, to see if it's worth investing more effort or see if we need to adjust our behavior. And so this is very related to our motivation and to notions of self-efficacy, the idea that I can change my circumstances. And this is ultimately has implications for mental health, as there are many psychopathologies that are known to involve disturbances in the sense of agency, like schizophrenia or obsessive-compulsive disorder or depression. And of course, the idea that our actions follow from our intentions and that we can control our actions is really critical to our societal notion of responsibility. And the legal system and the societal structures we have in terms of making a social contract. So our hope is that by understanding better how our sense of agency, how this experience of agency works, we might be able to inform and elucidate some of these other topics. So, especially because of its importance in society and in the legal system, it's really important to realize that our sense of agency can sometimes be wrong. We can just be mistaken sometimes. And so, for example, the Ouija board is a good example, which you might be familiar with. It was very popular in the beginning of the last century. And people thought that they could communicate with the spirits, by moving this little white plague. But studies show that, in fact, people were moving the little white plague intentionally. So the participants who were holding the plate were moving the plate through small involuntary actions that they weren't aware of. And similarly, when a magician shows us a bunch of cards and asks us to pick one, we might feel like we're free in choosing which card to pick, but we're normally biased by the magician, manipulated by the magician to pick the card he wants us to pick, and that's why he can guess which card we picked. And so these illusions of agency were really well demonstrated by Dan Wegner and colleagues, and one of these famous examples is the I Spy experiment. And so in that experiment, a participant was brought in together with a confederate that the participant didn't know was a confederate. And then the participants would sit and they would hold both a little board, which was kind of similar to the Ouija board, and they would move a cursor on a screen. So we can see the screen over there. And this is the little white plague. And so they would be both moving and moving the cursor around the screen, and the screen was full of little objects from the I Spy book. And while the participants were moving the cursor, they were also listening through headphones to words. And the results show that the participants felt more in control of stopping the cursor when the cursor stopped on top of a figure that matched the word they had recently heard. So imagine that there's a swan over here and the cursor stopped on the swan, and then participants were asked to judge whether they had done that. And so they would feel more in control of stopping it if they had recently heard over the headphones the word swan. And even though it was actually the Confederate that had stopped the cursor on that trial, so the participant didn't really stop it, but he thought he did because he had recently heard the word on which the cursor stopped. So this prior thought seemed to be what caused the people to feel like they were in control of something that they didn't do. And so this has led some people, namely Dan Wegner, to propose this view, which has been called willusionism. And that's the view that our conscious will is an illusion, because we have no direct access to the real causes of our behavior. The conscious will and our sense of agency are purely inferential. They're an inference we make after the fact, and so they can sometimes be confabulatory. And so in this view, our actions are triggered by unconscious brain activity, and then that leads to a certain outcome. And when we can link these actions and these outcomes, we can then post-dict after the fact that there must have been a conscious intention that led to this action. But we don't actually have any direct evidence for this, and there's no real causal relationship between this conscious intention and our actions. So this work was very important to highlight that our sense of agency can sometimes be misled and it can be fallible. But it does ignore the vast amount of information that we can actually get from our own bodies about what's happening right now. Yeah, so if you're sitting still and you're not doing anything and something happens, then that probably wasn't caused by you. And you have information from your own body about that. So a nice example of this rich and detailed information you can get about what from your body is the phenomenon of sensory attenuation, which is why you can't tickle yourself. So and this can be explained by the comparator model of agency, which was initially based on motor control kind of model, but it was then expanded to help us understand the sense of agency. And so within this model, when we have an intention to make a certain action, our brain has to convert that intention into muscle movements. And once we prepare those muscle movements, then the instructions are sent to the muscles. And at the time that the instructions are sent to the muscles, a copy of that information can be used to predict what the sensory consequences of the action will be. So we can make a prediction of what is going to happen. And then once it does happen, we have feedback from our senses, from vision or from touch, about what actually happens, and we can then compare how this prediction that we had about what was going to happen matches with the feedback that we get. And when these two signals match, there's actually a reduction in the sensation that we experience. And so you can't tickle yourself because you know exactly what's going to feel like. Whereas when another person tickles you, you can't predict exactly what they're going to do. And so there's a mismatch between the prediction that you made and the feedback that you get. And therefore, that's why it's more ticklish when somebody else tickles you. And because in this case, the mismatch between the prediction and the sensory feedback actually triggers an error signal, something that tells you, well, that's not you, it's somebody else. And so you don't really have a sense of agency, or you have a reduction in your sense of agency. And so this, lots of studies have supported this model and showed these sensory attenuation phenomena, for example. And this is this perspective is very interesting because it tells us that our sense of agency is actually grounded in our bodies and in the rich, detailed information we can get from our bodies. So it's not just all a narrative we tell ourselves after the fact. And it also shows that it's partially predictive. It's based on these predictive signals about what we think will happen as a consequence of our action. And so it's not all post hoc. It's not all after the fact. So again, while the comparator model provides a good grounding for the sense of agency in our bodies, it still only really allows us to link our actions to our outcome, to the outcomes, and it only allows us to do so retrospectively, because it's only once we know what the outcome is that we can compare it to our prediction. So on this view, the sense of agency could only really emerge after we know what the outcome is, and not before. And so our work has suggested there is also a prospective aspect to the sense of agency, and that how our intentions are linked to our actions, or how our intentions are created, is also important for our sense of agency. So, and this would suggest, therefore, that the sense of agency can emerge even before the outcome is known. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on now. So how does action selection, or how we decide what to do, relate to the sense of agency? So imagine that you've never played darts before and a friend invites you to play. And at the first time, you hit the bullseye. Are you really going to feel like you were in control of that? Or might you feel like maybe you were a bit lucky? Maybe you had some beginner's luck and you just managed to get it right. And so why should you feel like maybe you weren't completely in control of that? Well, that's because you had no idea what you were doing. You'd never done this before. And so why do we think that action selection, how the action selection process unfolds, should inform our sense of agency? Well, in this case, you need to know it wasn't all up to you. And so, for example, you might not be able to do that again. The next time you throw, you're maybe not likely to hit the bullseye again. And so you need to realize that you still need to work on your skills, despite the fact that you actually got your desired outcome of hitting the bullseye. And so the previous perspectives that I presented, both at the inferential view and in some ways the comparison, at least between what you would want to happen and what actually happens, those would suggest that you should feel in control because you got what you wanted. But actually how you got to your action and how you got there really kind of matters to the sense of agency. So, how can we try and test that in the laboratory is what we try to look into. And so to test this idea, we need to try and find a task where we can manipulate how easy or how hard it was for people to make an action. And so I'm going to run you through the experiment and explain a bit how we went about doing this. So essentially, we get some participants into the lab and we ask them to look at the screen and focus on the arrow in the center of the screen. And then they have two keys, one pointing to the left and one pointing to the right, to press. And so essentially, they see an arrow, a big arrow that either points to the right or the left, and they need to make a corresponding key press. Yeah. So if they see an arrow to the right, they should press the right key. And after a variable delay, a colored circle appears. And they are instructed to pay attention to the relationship between their actions and the outcomes, these colored circles. And then at the end of the trial, they're asked to judge how much control they felt over these colored circles. And so they do that by choosing a number from 1 to 8, where 1 means they felt no control, and 8 means they felt complete control. And so people will give a rating, for example, 6. So this is the basic agency paradigm, where people make an action and there's consequences to that action, and they try to figure out the relationships between actions and the colors that follow. But so to manipulate the action selection part, what we did was introduce a subliminal priming paradigm just before people saw the main arrow. So what actually happened was, while they were looking at the screen, we very briefly showed an arrow. So a little arrow appeared very, very quickly, and they didn't see this arrow because it appeared too quickly and it was actually masked by the second stimuli. So And we test that at the end of the study, where we try to make sure people didn't know which direction the arrow was pointing. And so then when they see the main arrow, the prime already starts, makes the brain start to prepare an action. And then when the main arrow appears, then they have to sort of deal with whatever the suggestion of the prime was. So if the prime pointed to the right and then the main arrow pointed to the right, then that's kind of easy to just go ahead and select, press the right key, and then they see a color, then they would make the ratings. So in this trial that I just showed you, the prime arrow pointed in the same direction as the target. And from other research, we know that that should be an easier action to make than in the case, for example, in which the arrow points in the opposite direction to the target. So when the arrow points to the left and then the target points to the right, one has to override the preparation in the brain that was triggered by the prime, even though the prime wasn't consciously perceived. And so, and in these cases, the actions are associated with different colors. So our question was, well, what happens to the sense of agency over the colors, depending on how, on this, the relationship between the prime and the target? And so first, just to clarify what happens in terms of the actions, well, we see that people, in fact, are slower at pressing the key, so they take longer to press the key when the prime and the target were incompatible compared to when they were compatible. And people also make more errors when the prime was in the wrong direction. So they're more likely to just go ahead and make the wrong key press because of the prime. But then, more interestingly, in terms of the sense of agency, what we see is that people actually feel less in control of the consequences of their actions, so of these colored circles, when the action selection was difficult because of the incompatible prime. So this means that how we decide what to do actually then influences our sense of agency over the consequences of our action. And so we saw here that the subliminal primes affected the fluency of action selection, so how easy or how hard it was to make the action. And it also influences people's conscious experience of the sense of agency. And although this effect is very small, as you can see, it is highly robust and has been shown in a number of studies. And so, essentially, this fluency of action selection can be seen as a prospective signal that informs the sense of agency, since this is known, even this is available even before the action is made, or at least at the time of the action. But how do we think that this works? How this works? How does the fluency of action selection come to influence the sense of agency? And so to look at this question in more detail, our colleagues could use fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, to probe how the brain is processing this information. And this allows us to get more detailed information about what's actually happening, because we can look at what information the brain is processing. And in particular, for example, from behavior alone, we can't really tell when the information was processed. So we don't know if the information about the ease or difficulty of action selection was processed during this action selection period, or if it was only available when people were making the judgments at the end of the trial about how much control they felt. And so the brain imaging helps us to get a better idea of that. So our colleagues looked at people's brain activity while they were doing this task during the period in which they were deciding what to do, and looked for brain regions that were sensitive both to whether action selection was easy or difficult when there were this compatible or incompatible priming, and that was also sensitive to the judgments of agency that people gave at the end of the trial, whether people actually reported feeling more or less in control. And so that showed that there was indeed a brain region, the angular gyrus, that was sensitive to this information about action selection and to the sense of agency. And so, especially when the primes were incompatible, as we can see over here, brain activity in this brain area was, so the more brain activity there was, then the lower the ratings of agency that people gave at the end of the trial. So essentially, activity in the angular gyrus was associated with a loss of agency. And interestingly, previous studies had already shown, already implicated this brain region in monitoring the outcomes of our actions. So in studies in which there would be a mismatch between a predicted outcome and the actual outcome, like in the tickling example, then more brain activity in this region was also associated with the loss of agency. And so this suggests that the angular gyrus and our brain is involved in monitoring online both what's happening at the time of the action and then later integrating that with information about the outcomes of our actions. So to summarize this experiment, what this suggests is that there's a prospective aspect to the sense of agency, which is linked to how easy or how hard it is to make our decisions and make our actions. And that when there's disfluency or difficulty in this action selection process, then there's a reduction in the sense of agency. And it seems that this signal is monitored online already at the time of the action and then can later be integrated with information about the outcome of our actions. But of course, you might wonder, well, what if people, what happens if people have a choice in what they're doing? Because in the previous study, they had to follow the direction, they had to follow the instructions of the arrows, so they didn't really have a choice in what they were doing. And also, what happens if people are aware of these little biasing influences? So, because in the previous study, these subliminal primes weren't consciously seen by the people, so they didn't know that they were being biased. So, you know, you might predict that if you know somebody's telling you go right, but you actually decide to go left, maybe you'll feel more in control because you're going against what the suggestion was. So to try and investigate this, we used another paradigm, which is called the Erickson-Flanker paradigm. And I'm going to get to that a little in a moment. And so there, a letter appears flanked by some other letters, which are distractors. And so people are supposed to focus on the letter in the middle. So the instructions are that if you see an S in the center of the screen, you need to press the left key. If you see an H, you need to press the right key. Or if you see an O, you can decide what to do. You can decide whether to press the left or right key. It's up to you. And so what happens in forced choice trials, or trials in which we tell people what to do, is that they would see a screen like this. So the letter in the center is the one they want to focus on, and then the letters around, the flankers, are distractors that they're supposed to ignore. But so in this case, all of the letters are the same. So this is considered a compatible trial. And again, we predict this would be easier than a situation in which the letters might be different. But so in this case, it's very easy for people to make the right key press, and then they will see a color associated with that. But then on these other trials in which the flankers are different from the target, the instruction that they actually have to follow, then so the S's suggest you go to the left, but the H tells you you need to go to the right. So that causes a conflict between these two different actions that you want to make. And so that means it's a little bit harder for you then to make the right key press. And then these trials are associated with another color. And now for the free choice trials, where people can choose what to do, what happens is we show this O in the center, which tells the participants they can just pick what to do. But we also show these flankers, which will either suggest go to the right or suggest go to the left. So in this case, the flankers suggest go to the right. So if the participant makes a right key press, that means they've made an action that is compatible with the flanker's suggestion. And then these trials are associated with another color. And finally, if people see this free choice target, the O, which is surrounded by a suggestion saying go to the left, but then they decide to go to the right, then their action is incompatible with the flankers. So they've made the opposite action to that suggested by the flankers. And so then they make their key press, and this is associated with another color. So in what did our results show us? So we see that indeed people were slower at pressing the key when the flankers were incompatible with the target, so these red bars. And this was especially the case in the forced choice trials where they had to follow the instruction. Although there was also a small difference in the same direction when people could choose what to do. And then what's more interesting is that when people had a choice in what to do, we see that they were actually biased to follow the suggestions of the flankers, so they were more likely to press the right key if the flanker suggested the right action. And so this was more than chance level. So they were biased by these flankers. And then we see in the forced choice trials where they had to follow the instructions that they also make more errors when the flankers are incompatible with the target. So what this tells us is that indeed these flankers affected action selection fluency. They made the action selection sometimes harder or easier, and they biased people's free choices. And then what happens in terms of the sense of agency? Well, we see again the same pattern, that people felt less in control of their actions in the incompatible cases. So when they made an action that was incompatible with the flankers. And so the difficulty in the action selection process led to a reduction in people's sense of agency. And so this was the case regardless of whether people had a choice in what to do or had to follow an instruction. And as we see here, it was also regardless of whether people were aware of these biasing influences. And in fact, if we run a similar study with free choice trials and with the subliminal priming paradigm, we see exactly the same results. So this tells us, again, that the selection fluency affects the sense of agency, regardless of whether people have a choice of what to do and or not, and whether they are aware of these biasing influences. So how can we think about, again, why action selection fluency might influence the sense of agency? Well, so we think this is related to the flow state, which you might be familiar with, and that a lot of people, especially in sports, for example, like surfing or tennis, or people who play music and say in jazz improvisations, so they feel like they go into a state in which they're so concentrated in what they're doing, and actions just flow from the other actions. They don't have to stop and think about what they're doing. Things just flow from intentions to actions to outcomes to the next action. And so this is also kind of related to expertise. So the more people know about what they're doing, the more they might get into this state. Because also, if the task you're doing is too easy, you can just get bored. But if the task you're doing is too hard, then you might get frustrated. So there's sort of a middle point in which the task just messes your abilities, and then you can get into this state. And as well, then if we know a lot about the situation, we can better predict what the consequences of our actions will be. And therefore, we can also see how the fluency of action selection, how easy it is to get to your action, might be predictive of the fact that you're going to get a good outcome or not. And so you might learn to use the information about action selection fluency because it's predictive of getting good outcomes. But of course, paradoxically, some people in this flow state actually feel a loss of control. And so some people actually report that they feel completely out of control, and they might even feel like their actions are sort of being controlled by other forces. And this is kind of associated with the fact that in this state, people don't stop to think, and they also don't stop to think about themselves. So the self kind of falls into the background. And so it seems like this loss of self is kind of what leads people to feel a loss in their sense of agency. So, and also sometimes, of course, engaging in difficult tasks, like if you study really hard for an exam, or if you decide to climb a mountain, then there you're going to make a very difficult action, but you're, of course, motivated to do that. And so in some cases, this difficulty and, you know, facing challenges and overcoming them can, of course, also enhance our sense of agency. So this highlights the point that that the context matters. So the situation in which we're in is going to modulate whether difficulty might lead us to feel more or less in control. And of course, also, so if you study really hard for an exam, once you come to do the exam, then doing the exam will actually be easier than if you hadn't studied at all. And this highlights another point, which is that we can look at the sense of agency at many different levels. And so you can think about a very simple movement, just moving a hand over here or moving a hand over here. And or you can see that that movement is part of a goal, say picking up a glass of water. And that is actually motivated by the fact that I'm thirsty. And so then I drink my water and that's satisfied. And so looking at these different levels of complexity of the movements and of the intentions, kind of related to what Al was discussing before, these proximal and distal intentions, means that also the sense of agency over these different levels might integrate different kinds of information and lead us to maybe consider obstacles or difficulties in different ways. So I hope I have shown you overall that a strong sense of agency is normally associated with a smooth flow from intentions to actions to outcomes. And that when there's a disruption at any point, then the sense of agency tends to be reduced. And so within the classical model, we can make predictions about what's going to happen when we make an action or when we prepare the action, and then we can compare that to the outcomes of our actions. And when there's a mismatch, then this error signal leads to a reduction in the sense of agency. And this is what we showed with the sensory attenuation and the tickle experiment. But our research shows that there is also another aspect to the sense of agency, which is related to how our intentions come about and how our intentions are converted into actions. And that difficulty or disfluency here can also lead to a reduction in the sense of agency. And so this means that the sense of agency is not just about the outcomes of our actions. It's also about how we control ourselves and our own bodies. And then, of course, the sense of agency is also informed by more conceptual or inferential processes, as we saw in the first experiments with the iSpy, and which might lead, in some cases, for people to misinterpret the situation. And so, or it might have independent effects of whether you feel more or less in control in terms of whether you have a choice or not. Okay, and so to go back to the original question that we had here, how do we know what we're doing? And so we saw that the sense of agency integrates lots of information about what's happening over time. And that information ranges from internal bodily signals, whether about action selection or about predictions of what might happen. And that's integrated with our perception of the external world, the sensory feedback we get about what actually happens. And it's also influenced by our beliefs, general beliefs, or even more specific and contextual beliefs and inferences we can make. And so we think that there's this prospective sense of agency which implies that our sense of agency might emerge even before the action is made. And before we know what the outcomes of our actions are. And we think this component is important because it may be an advanced predictor that we're going to get a successful outcome. So although good control over our bodies and our actions can't assure us that we're going to get a good outcome, it might generally be predictive of getting a good outcome. And then this prospective sense of agency is also going to help us bridge the time interval between making an action and observing an outcome, which in many everyday life situations might actually be pretty long intervals. So we need something to track before we actually know what's going to happen, or because we actually know the consequences of our actions. And so I'll just finish by considering some implications and open questions and speculation about how this perspective on the sense of agency might affect other ideas. And so we suggest that the subjective experience the subjective experience that we have of our actions might play an important role in becoming responsible and in being responsible. And so the sense of agency may serve as an experiential marker that might help us to learn how to do better next time. And of course, for example, the model I presented before implies that as we learn about the environment we're in and we learn to predict better what the consequences of our actions are, we might be able to have a more accurate sense of agency. And indeed, disruptions in this prediction feedback comparison have been associated with psychopathologies like schizophrenia. And so although we may not be as free or as in control as we think or as we would like to think that we are, maybe that realization itself can be freeing, because maybe we can learn to better distinguish when we are in control or not and learn to better focus our resources. And introducing this perspective component to the sense of agency leaves open the possibility for online adjustments to our actions, which the more retrospective accounts didn't really allow for. And so maybe monitoring these disruptions during action selection and during the action preparation and the actual that one actually makes might allow for online corrections or online changes of mind and then corrective actions. So this is, again, especially relevant in more long-term actions. So tracking the decision process, realizing that you might not be an expert and really know what you're doing, could inform us about what to do next. So, for example, if I'm using a ticket machine in a new city that I've never seen, I might really not be sure what keys to press. And when I get my ticket, I have an outcome, but I might not be completely sure this is the correct ticket. So maybe I want to try and ask somebody like a local or a staff member to make sure this is the right ticket before I get into the train and get a fine. So that's kind of it. Thank you for your time and to my sponsors.
Thank you very much indeed. For a wonderful definition. Now we can all go into the flow on our separate tables for 5 minutes with a perfect sense of agency and discuss what's been going on. And then from that will arise questions for Neura. So thank you very much. And we'll now discuss this amongst ourselves. If I can take you out of the flow and into a sense of disrupted agency, who's got questions? Wow, that's wonderful. You one, and then you two.
Neura, thank you very much for a very interesting talk. It strikes me that the people who will be sponsoring you from now on are all the advertising agencies, because your study has enormous application into how advertising agencies can manipulate people into choosing product A over product B. You would take a picture of a Toyota car, you would surround it with some text and subtle things which have a T in it, and to make people feel that they're in control of making the decision to buy a Toyota and not a Volkswagen. What do you think?
Well, I think indeed advertising is probably already using some of these methods, maybe more or less unconsciously, or understanding more or less how that might work. But of course, you know, in some ways, advertising, you know, you see a poster for one thing, you see another poster for the same thing. And that means, you know, you see a poster for McDonald's, you see another poster for McDonald's. That means when you see the McDonald's, you can, you know, just see the McDonald's much more easily because you were primed to think about the McDonald's, and then suddenly, you know, you're hungry and you want to go in and eat. So I think in some ways advertising is already doing a lot of that. I don't know if this might help or them be more effective, which I don't know if we want them to be or not, but yeah. I don't know.
No,
haven't been approached by them yet, but yeah. We'll see.
Advertising, and it's all a question of manipulation.
Yeah.
And again, you know, at the risk of repeating what other people have said, there are certain philosophers, and I'm thinking of Gurdjieff, who come to mind, who feel that we really are not free until we understand the mechanics of our mind. When we understand how our mind works, and when we understand why we make these choices, then we cease have a possibility of not doing it mechanically, and then we have a possibility for free will. And your talk has really very well pinpointed some of those processes.
Yes, indeed. I think this work is interesting to highlight this, the fact that maybe sometimes we might feel more in control just because things were so easy. And so I think being aware of this as a cue that we use, because it's also not completely clear, for example, in the priming study, of course, people didn't know that they were using the fluency of action selection as a cue. So it's then unclear whether generally people are aware of this or not. And maybe the beginner's luck kind of example does mean people have some idea that, you know, sometimes they might not feel completely in control for a good reason, and that has to do with, you know, how they get to their action. So I think generally understanding how our sense of agency, our experience of agency works might help precisely elucidate, you know, when we might be a little bit wrong or misled and lead us to be more in control, actually, of what we're doing and experiencing.
Okay, let's move on.
Schizophrenia, OCD, and mm-hmm. Do you envisage adapting these techniques as a curative process, and by maybe positive flankers, so in inducing a stronger sense of agency and real sense of agency as a way of positive reinforcement?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Indeed, some of our colleagues have done a study which is not yet published, but where they looked at patients with schizophrenia and controls using the priming paradigm that I showed before. And essentially they show that patients with schizophrenia, although their actions are primed, so they're still, you know, slower at pressing the key when the prime is in the opposite direction to the target, they don't use that information at all for their judgments of agency that they give at the end of the trial. So while their action is affected by the primes, they don't then feel like more or less in control based on the action selection side of things. And that's consistent with other studies that have shown, for example, also that in schizophrenia, they don't really tend to use predictive information. So in the prediction feedback kind of comparison, they just rely on the outcomes. They only rely on external information, and they don't rely on internal information, either predictive or, in this case, more prospective action selection. So it's definitely a question that I think hasn't really been studied, whether maybe training these patients in some ways might help them to shift their integration of information from focusing only on the outcome and on external inputs to actually focusing on more internal signals. But that's definitely a hope or an idea to explore.
At the beginning of your talk, you made a statement, we have no direct access of the real causes of our behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So is this kind of thought process that we go through to improve that situation?
So, I mean, that statement was a suggestion from Dan Wegner, and that statement is what led Dan Wegner and what leads other people to suggest that our conscious will is an illusion. And I think that I think our awareness of the causal mechanisms, unconscious mechanisms and so on that might lead to some of our actions or lead to little biases in our action preparation, which might lead us one way or the other, we might have limited access to that information. But I think there's also evidence that we do have some good, I mean, there's also good evidence that we do perceive things from the inside, that we have information about what's going on right now in our bodies, and in terms of the predictive information that we can get from knowing what the actions we're going to make. And I think that doesn't completely support this view that we have no direct access to the causal influences.
May I use a strange phrase? Do we have the faith that this is going to be so?
Do I have the faith that?
This is going to be so. We are going to succeed.
I don't know. I don't know if it's a faith. I don't know. Okay. I think I'm a little agnostic. I don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
You're talking about a sort of black box in there, and we've been talking about mind. But I would suggest that actually, you know, we're 70% muscle and bone, and 70% of our nervous systems to actually operate the mechanics are muscles, joints, ligaments, tendons, and bones. The word emotion comes from the word motion. What moves you is your muscles. You can't, for example, get angry unless you first tense up. If you're already tense, it doesn't take much to be angry. And we found, that's the Sunflower Trust for helping children with learning difficulties, that when we get their muscles balanced, integrated, and well for lying, sitting, standing, walking, and off-road, actually the improvements we make in terms of their self-confidence and self-esteem, not even looking at the fine neurology, which we also do, and the nutrition, which we also do, their IQ, self-confidence, and self-esteem. So by far the most effective way in terms of time and money of helping people be balanced, integrated, and well is helping them to fit more correctly and more synchronously within their own bodies. And that has a positive emotional effect, physiological effects, and every other effect on their IQ, etc. So a vast amount of time and money doing your PhD, looking at this black box, measuring what's going in and what's coming out, is great, but it's not the most cost-effective and efficient way of helping people to be balanced, integrated, and well.
Thank maybe. You. Yeah, or maybe this work highlights why it is that those things work, and that's because these internal signals are really important. But yeah. Maybe we already knew that. But some people forgot about it. I think that's the issue.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank you.
You mentioned in your, or you showed in your talk, the picture of a darts board and the enthusiastic amateur who might hit the bullseye at his first shot. Mm-hmm. This was presumably based on the intention of the thrower, although at that stage, possibly the intention was more hope than anything more positive. But moving from there to something more of focused intention, where the agency factor, the control factor, you might believe to have a greater impact on the outcome, and indeed the professional darts thrower, from that point of view, has a much better chance of hitting that bullseye on a regular basis. And so the power of intention can have an impact. And indeed, we hear that collaborative intention has an even greater power of impact. But moving beyond that to unshakable belief, and in those instances, it would seem that that power has the effect of actually suspending the laws of physics and chemistry, in the sense that people walk over hot coals, others seem to be able to imbibe strychnine consciously without any impact, purely because they, in those instances, they believe without any doubt that in fact the outcome will be what they intend it to be. And I wonder if in these situations, is that an expression of free will? And if so, whose?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It's a rather packed question for you.
Indeed. I mean, I think, so in the model that I presented here, where we see that the sense of agency integrates lots of different kinds of information. I think it's the key point is that these different bits of information can have more or less importance in a given situation. So in some cases, our beliefs might be really critical, and we might sort of be downweigh the other bits of information and really focus on the beliefs, or vice versa. You can change these balances of how these different cues are integrated. Now, whether having a very strong intention means we are more or less free in making actions, that I don't really know. I think the issue with the discussion about free will is mostly the issue of how we're defining that. And I think we can define that in pretty different ways. And that has a big influence on how we see that we can or cannot have free will. So I don't know. I don't quite know what to say.
Okay, thanks very much. Who has the microphone? Yes.
Thanks, Noura, for that. That's a useful diagram. Now, you also showed us the dartboard. And my question is, can one from your research develop practical cognitive tools in order to help, referring to the dartboard, the rather familiar cases of top sportsmen, for example, not being able to let the dart out of their hand, or golfers who are desperate to hit the ball but just can't swing because the sense of agency or the volition is so high? Can one develop cognitive tools to help? It's called the yips in sport, you know.
It's like choking?
Absolutely choking. Yeah. And also musicians who, you know, take a deep breath and cannot blow, and that, it's all that. Now, is a strong sense of agency the same as a strong volition? Around our table, we were discussing what we mean by agency. Of course, it's a huge thing. But can one take this to the next stage and develop therapeutic tools, is my question.
Yes, that's definitely a good question. And it's... I think it hasn't quite been done yet of trying to think about exactly how one could try and convert this into some more therapeutic kind of approaches. But the idea is that one might be able to do that, and then we can try and see if it does indeed make a difference.
I mean, you mentioned obsessional behavior. I mean, you know, no one really wants to get up from their bed 20 times to check that the door is shut.
Exactly.
At night, but you don't want to do it, but you do it.
And so there, what you might say, for example, in the case of obsessive compulsive disorder, is that people are not actually processing the outcomes of their actions properly to realize they've just done what they needed to do. So they have a feeling of incompleteness, that they don't know what the outcome was, and so they do it again because they don't feel like that was properly achieved.
So very briefly, would you say they're not in the moment, they're not mindful? Because if they were mindful...
Sure. So I think mindfulness is definitely an interesting way of maybe becoming, I mean, by training mindfulness, maybe you can become more aware of exactly what's happening, more aware of exactly this action part, and then also exactly what the outcome is, and therefore kind of improve how this comparison process and how this information gets integrated by actually processing what's really happening. But then to go back to the point you made before about, you know, what's happening right now versus, you know, do I think I can change things in the world generally? And of course, I think it's important to note that there's sort of a state experience of agency related to a particular action. And so as I was saying, also, you can think about the sense of agency at multiple levels. So when you have big intentions that are converted into particular actions, which might have other sort of lower level kind of actions, and similarly, you might have more of a trait aspect. So the locus of control kinds of theories that showed some people just feel generally more in control of their actions and of the world, and other people just are much more fatalistic and they think they can't really control much. So the trait aspect is going to influence the state aspect. So what you're experiencing right now as you're making a particular action is going to be affected by how generally you think that you might or not be in control of some things. And I don't know, in the case of choking, maybe there it's really just maybe a fear that you're not going to get the outcome. And so maybe overcoming that fear and understanding that you can control what you're doing and so on is going to help there. But yeah.
Okay, I think we ought to move on. I have a question for you, and that relates, we're just flirting with pathology. And I was just wondering about hysterical paralysis, where these people have an intact neurology, but absolutely no sense of agency at all. Do you have any data on that?
Yes, there. I mean, I don't know about hysterical paralysis specifically, but yeah, that's probably integrated. There's been a study or a couple of studies recently looking at functional movement disorders, patients with functional movement disorders, which probably would include that particular manifestation. And they're using this particular paradigm. They did show that generally the patients with functional movement disorders seem to feel less, maybe less control over their actions than normal controls. So there is maybe there a sense that there's kind of some disruption in how these are in the action experience, which is associated with this loss of control, which might even be more general than to the particular symptoms that they have. So yeah. So again, it is a question. I was recently in Italy where they are researching these patients, and they were precisely trying to think about how and starting some trials with the particular therapy to see if training, learning the relationship between actions and outcomes might boost their sense of agency and somehow translate to improvements in their pathologies.
That would be enormously important.
So I think they're just starting now, so we'll see what happens.
Who's got the mic? Yes, over there.
Muscular action, sort of overt muscular action, but I think there is a different kind of intention which seems to take place in a different part of one's mind. And I'm thinking particularly of some experiments years ago I did where I found I was able to do, to a very small extent, psychokinesis. And just imagining this little rotor turning. And I found I had to wipe out from my mind any kind of ordinary intention, the sort one would use for muscular action. Just imagine it moving. Just imagine it. And as soon as it moved, I got very excited and it stopped, and of course, and so on and so on. But I think this kind of intention also applies to, for example, healing. And of course, it's been studied over many years by William Tiller and his group, who've actually been able to store intention in an electronic device. But that's another story.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Very interesting.
Let's move on. Who's got the mic? David.
Thank you. I just want to build on Eddie's question. As I mentioned this at our table, that I'm a golfer. And I think that obviously you need to develop, as you were implying, a certain level of skill, you know, to achieve a certain type of performance. But at a certain point, you actually need to get yourself out of the way. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in a sense of flow, I mean, I think probably this general experience for anybody who plays a game, you play your best when you actually don't have a strong sense of agency when you're in the flow. What I suppose is happening, and I'm just relating this back to Peter's point last night about Rupert Spira, that if you can get into a sort of more non-dual state where things are, you're not trying that hard and you're not separating yourself from the object of what you're trying to do, you actually transcend the need for a sense of agency. And I'll just give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was in the second round of the singles handicap competition at St. Andrews. And
thank you, David.
I was done. I was down about two or three down at the 14th. And for the next six holes, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19... I hold nothing less than a 6 to 8 foot putt, and I hold two 20 foot putts. And on the 18th, I was in this situation where I had a very poor approach shot. Then I thinned my third shot across the green. So I was left with a 20-foot uphill putt to save the match. And so sometimes I say to myself, I need a miracle now. And the thing went straight in the hole. And my opponent was sort of completely floored because this was the fifth hole in a row when I'd saved it by holing the... And on the 19th, I had a six-footer to win the match. And I was in this state. I had no doubt that it was going in, which it did. And I won the match. And he was kind of shell-shocked. but it's just a sort of example of... If I'd tried, my God, I've got to get this in. If I'd had that kind of thought, I'm sure I would have missed.
Yes.
There is a sort of, you know...
Yeah, there is a sort of a paradox between... But also that's related to... So some people suggest that the sense of agency... So you can have a very clear conscious experience of being in control right now. But also often that experience of agency, so I mean you feel, I mean you're doing things and you might not think about, oh, what am I doing? Do I feel in control or not about what I'm doing? But there's still this processing, I mean there's still a monitoring of what's happening, what's going to happen next. Am I actually in control? Do I need to make corrective actions? Is somebody else controlling what's happening? But that's sitting in the background. And so the idea is actually when everything is going well, like in the flow state, then there is no need for the sense of agency to come to the foreground, for you to become especially aware of that, or for you to become especially aware of yourself. But that doesn't mean that the monitoring isn't going on in the background. And then it's precisely when there's a disruption, something goes wrong, that you suddenly, the sense of agency suddenly comes to the fore as you feel out of control. And that's, you know, that's the case. You go into a room, you turn on the light switch, you are not thinking about it, you're just doing it. And everything is going right. But if something goes wrong, something unexpected happened, that's when it comes to the forefront. So I think there is also that issue in terms of how, of whether this experience, even though it's a subjective experience, needs to be in the foreground of our consciousness, or whether we can still consider it as a subjective experience, even if it sort of just sits there in the background, coloring your general experience of what's happening now.
Okay, thanks very much. Bernard, I think this has to be the last question.
Neuro, thank you. over here.
I
was very intrigued by your reference to jazz.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if I inferred the right message. So my understanding is that you would think that when you were a jazz player, in some sense that was the epitome of free will, because you become the center and you're sort of leading the development. But then I think you also said that some people feel that's the time when they feel most mechanical, because in some sense you're actually, you know, you're interacting with a group rather than just being yourself. So, and I found this intriguing because it seemed to be a very close analogy to what we do as you walk through life. In a sense, we're all jazz playing through life. So what was the actual prime message you were trying to get across in making the reference to jazz? An advocate's free will or not?
The reference was related to this flow state that you can get into, and that in some cases you might perceive as being perfectly in control, so much so that you don't have to think about what you're doing. You don't have to stop and worry whether you're doing the right things or not, because everything is going smoothly. And so that's the sense in which the fluency is going to improve your sense of agency, and that a disruption in that process is going to suddenly make you wake up to this in more conscious discourse that there's something going on wrong. So and I think that the jazz example is very interesting precisely because of also the dialogue with other people. And so I was recently at a discussion in Colombia about precisely improvisation, and I mean they discussed a bit how you can think of freedom in improvisation, and how actually to do jazz improvisation or improvisation in music, you need to have some rules and you need to have some constraints. It's not like there's every single possibility, because if there was, actually you wouldn't really be able to make probably make an action and wouldn't really make sense within the context. So there's quite a lot of limitation that comes in, but it's precisely then within those limits that people can be somewhat free and choose different things. So I think maybe that is an interesting case to think about the free will and then generally freedom, and realize that the constraints might seem like they're making you unfree, but maybe they're needed for that freedom. I don't know.
Okay, thanks very much.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Just one more little question.
One more little, three or four words. Two words. Learnt helplessness. Can you, any way of unlearning helplessness?
Is there any other? Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a very good question. I mean, I think probably the evidence is that there is. And so people who are seriously depressed and have this learned helplessness can sometimes, with the right help, unlearn that learned helplessness. So I do think that there's something to be done there. And well, the precise mechanisms of how you go about it, I don't know, might vary. But hopefully this research can actually help enlighten what might be the best mechanism, best way to change that.
Okay, thanks very much. If we looked at your graphs, one of the things we saw was that the actual change in effect was very small. It was significant, but it was actually small in terms of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So this has been a sort of underlying concern of people here as to whether, in fact, the effects that you're showing are going to be important in life. Do you have a view?
It's definitely a very good question. I think it might be related partially to how people are aware or not of using this information. And because the issue is, of course, there's a lot of, so that, you know, you see this small difference, and the small difference is there in a lot of people. But actually, you know, there is a lot of intersubject variability. So some subjects don't show this effect at all, and some subjects show it a lot more. And it is a question that we don't know yet of, you know, what differentiates these different subjects. Is it that they can use or cannot use this information about action selection fluency? Or is it that they want to use it or don't want to use it? So it's definitely a good question how this influences people in their daily lives. But I'd say it's probably related to how they're interpreted. They're interpreting both the question of thinking about what the sense of agency means and then whether they want to use that sort of information or not. But yeah, I think being aware of this as a cue is then important for people to make that decision.
That's excellent. Okay, so we'll have to watch this space. Okay, so thanks very much, Neera. That was a wonderful, clear and lucid talk. So let's all thank Neera very much indeed.